And it is today's Topical Currents, Wednesday edition, Joseph Cooper, along with Bonnie Berman. And we're in our at-your-service mode today. The topic is landlord-tenant laws. Changes were enacted during the last Florida legislative session, which we'll review, of course. And we'll also take your calls. We have an esteemed panel with us. The number is 1-800-743-WLRN, 1-800-743-9576. And Bonnie, email?
Email is radio@WLRN.org, and you can tweet us at Topical Currents.
Our panel includes Jeffrey Hearns of Legal Services of Greater Miami. Welcome to you, Jeffrey. Good to have you.
Thank you.
And we have Miami-Dade County Consumer Advocate Leonard Elias. He's here to answer your questions as well.
And also with us is attorney Michael Bernholtz. He's been part of landlord-tenant seminars. He was formerly of Legal Services of Greater Miami and is in private practice and usually advocates for owners. Welcome to you, Michael Bernholtz.
Thank you.
So let's start with you, Leonard Elias. As Joe said, a number of changes took place at the last legislative session. So as of July 1st, a number of significant changes were made to the Florida Landlord-Tenant Act. Can you tell us some of the most contentious issues affected by the new law?
Well, perhaps one of the most contentious ones is involving partial acceptance of rent. And in the past, when a landlord accepted partial payment, then the landlord was precluded from filing an eviction case against the tenant. The law has changed and has made set forth various procedures.
He's got his legal briefs.
Yes, we're going to have some papers rattling
right,
today.
It's now clear that management or a property owner can accept a partial payment of rent and also proceed with an eviction that same month if the landlord or property owner does one of three things. One, give the resident a receipt for the partial rent accepted, or two, place the amount of the partial rent into the court registry if an eviction is filed, or three, post a new three-day notice. So this law, to a degree, benefits tenants who can only afford a certain amount but not the whole amount, and it also allows landlords the opportunity to accept a smaller amount with the opportunity of proceeding as long as they give the proper notice, and if an eviction is filed, then the monies are placed in the court registry.
How does that benefit the tenant if they can still be evicted?
Well, because in the past, some landlords wouldn't accept partial rent, and they would just evict the tenant, in which case the tenant was displaced.
I see.
So to that degree, the tenant has the opportunity to at least work things out, and the landlord would then give the tenant written document stating, you know, how much was given, until what time they have to pay, and make it a little more understandable and more. There's more sensitivity rather than simply displacing a tenant.
Michael Bernholtz, your opinion on this matter?
Well, I think the change in the law presents a lot of questions that I think will need some guidance from the courts over the coming months. Because I think there are some pitfalls still for landlords and for tenants. I agree with Mr. Elias as far as I think there may be a benefit to both parties. It may help narrow some of the issues, remove payment of rent or at least partial rent from the issues. Generally, this is seen as something that's positive for landlords and the ability to continue to collect rent or at least see a guarantee of rent coming into either whether it's the court or whether it's the landlord actually accepting rent, and that can help especially a lot of owners that may not have huge amounts of cash on hand. I'm taking a little bit of a wait and see approach with my clients because I think there's some ambiguity in the way the law is written, and my fear, at least from my landlord clients, is that if they don't follow things exactly to a T, that there are plenty of tenants' rights attorneys and tenant advocates out there who are going to hold my client's feet to the fire, and it may cause questions. So I'm not necessarily telling my clients to change how they operate right now. I think this is something that has a lot of potential. It should be a good thing for landlords, but I'm waiting at least at the moment to see a little more guidance.
Well, let's talk to one of those people that helps the tenants, Jeffrey Hearn. And do you think most of the changes that have been enacted favor landlords rather than tenants?
Yes, I think on the whole they were written for the landlords. The landlords are the ones who wanted to make these changes come into place.
And was there anybody advocating in the legislature for the tenants?
There were at least two advocates, an attorney from Florida Legal Services and from Florida Consumer Action Network, who were lobbying against these changes and working hard to try to improve them. You know, the concern that we had about this provision was that you know, tenants are going to be misled into paying rent, and then they're still going to be evicted. And if they're going to end up losing their house and be evicted, then you know, maybe they should use that money to help them relocate, come up with a new security deposit, the moving costs. You know,
so if you pay half the rent, you could be gone in 3 days anyway.
Well, you're not going to be gone in 3 days. That's just the beginning of the process. The eviction process requires a notice to be given to the tenant first. So that's what that 3-day notice is. It says you have 3 days to either pay me the rent or get out. And if you don't do one of those two things, I'm going to file an eviction, which is a court case.
And how long does that take?
Well, it can depend. I would say probably the fastest would be 3 to 4 weeks, and it could be longer if it's disputed. In Florida, we have a very unique statute which says that in order for a tenant to defend an eviction, they must put the money into the court registry. You know, any other defendant in a court case gets a hearing, but tenants don't get a hearing. You know, we're talking about somebody's home, and you would think that we want to make sure we do it right when we're talking about somebody's home. But the law doesn't say that. It says that if you don't put the money into the court registry, you waive all of your defenses and you lose and the landlord wins automatically.
Hmm. What about security deposit disputes? What's the difference between, say, normal wear and tear of a dwelling versus negligent behavior? And who decides who's in the right there?
That's a classic question and one that I think the facts will drive the answer to that. And it's one that I know we see disputes all the time between landlords and tenants. You're correct that the law does allow the tenant normal wear and tear, but that is a subjective standard. I always recommend for my clients to make sure you're documenting the condition of the premises when a tenant moves out. Likewise, I would tell my tenant clients to do the same thing. The statute does have a process for the return of deposits. And ultimately, if there is a dispute, it's going to be up to a court to determine what is reasonable and what is unreasonable. But there are a number of steps in the return of the deposit and in the ability of the tenant to object to claims raised by the landlord.
And does the loser of that case have to pay a court cost for the other?
Correct. If the dispute winds up in court, there is a statutory provision, as well as most of the written leases out there, will allow for the prevailing party to recover reasonable attorney's fees and costs.
Here's another one regarding attorney's fees, which seems a little slanted. Attorney fees may not be awarded in a personal injury claim for damages based on a breach of duty to maintain the rental premises. How can that be?
I think what this one was getting at is that most personal injury cases, the attorneys collect a contingency fee based upon the award. And I think what was happening is some attorneys were, in the personal injury context, we're trying to use the landlord-tenant statute to get fees separately from that normal process for a personal injury lawsuit. So this was one that I know that the individuals who were advocating for tenants up there, this was not high on their list of concerns, because if there is serious personal injury, you will be able to recover attorney's fees.
Oh, you will?
Correct.
Again, it's landlord-tenant issues today, and our phones are open. The number is 1-800-743-9576, 1-800-743-9576. We'll take your emails, radio@wlrn.org, and we'll also read your tweets at Topical Currents.
And let's take a first caller. This is Jose in Boca Raton. Hey there. Hey,
good afternoon. Yes, I've been a property manager for about 25 years. One thing that the person talking about the putting the rent in the registry didn't mention there, if they claim the defense or something else, but if they have paid and they claim they pay the rent, they don't have to put the money in the registry of the court. And what I found I worked in Broward, Dade, and Palm Beach, and D.C., and other states, is that in the past, the reason they put that law was that people will claim that something didn't work in the house, and they will spend 3 months without paying rent. And when you find out that wasn't true, and that's what they put the law there, that they had to pay the rent in the registry because the tenants were abusing the law. And that's what happened in the past because I worked in Florida since 89 as a landlord, as a manager probably, I will say.
Michael, you want to?
That's correct. And I think that the purpose of requiring the tenant to post money in the court registry is to make sure that the tenant's reasons for not paying aren't simply that the tenant doesn't have money or doesn't want to pay, and that if the tenant does have legitimate claims, and I'm sure I'm going to get some pushback from our tenant's rights attorney, but is provided that the tenant has legitimate claims, legitimate reasons, and it's not simply I don't have the money or I don't want to pay, it removes that from the equation and says to the tenant, you need to deposit this money in the court registry. It will be up to the court to determine what happens at the end of it. It may go back to you as the tenant. It may go to the landlord. But to me, that seems like a reasonable provision.
Yeah. Jeffrey?
The problem is the mechanism is set up for defaults. The default is the standard reaction in a case, and it's the exception when it's not a default. Florida Legal Services did a study of evictions filed in Miami-Dade County in certain zip codes and found that only, you know, even when tenants filed answers, almost, I think it was 75% of them were struck by the court. And some of them stated defenses saying, look, I may have some claim against the landlord. And I guess what makes Florida unique is that you don't go to a hearing. A lot of states do require that you have to go to a hearing, and then if the case gets continued and goes on longer, then the tenant has to put money into the court. But here, that tenant never has that opportunity to go and see that judge and tell their story. And you're talking about a lot of unrepresented people who may not be able to articulate the fact that they have a defense, that they have a legitimate claim.
How about government subsidized housing, especially Section 8 housing and eviction? What's the process there? And what rights do those tenants have?
Well, there's a lot of different programs, but in the Section 8 voucher program, which is where a tenant has a subsidy, they rent from a private landlord, and a housing authority pays the difference in the rent. The tenant pays a portion, mm-hmm. and the housing authority pays the portion. There are special regulations. There are not a lot of protections. They're pretty much follow Florida law, but the landlord is required to maintain the premises, and if they don't do that, the housing authority will stop paying. The tenant can't be evicted if the housing authority stops paying. And, you know, they have to notify the housing authority if there's a change in the landlord-tenant relationship. And the rent is set. They can't change the rent and accept side payments from the tenant and say, look, pay me an extra $100 under the table. They do that, they can face penalties as well.
I think it's important to know what the new law...
This is Leonard Elias.
...has to say about this issue in certain subsidized government housing. In the past, if management did not file an eviction against a resident within 45 days of the resident committing crime or noncompliance on the property, the landlord was prohibited by law from filing the eviction action. And the problem was that often management didn't find out about the noncompliance until after 45 days had gone by. The new law allows management to file within 45 days from the time management discovers the crime or noncompliance as to when it related to when the eviction action could be filed. So in the past, it was 45 days as a definite amount. Now it's when the management discovers the noncompliance. So it allows a little more flexibility.
Mm-hmm. It's a little confusing. But since we mentioned this in our promo, let's just, before we get to the more calls, we mentioned the issue of bed bugs in our promo for the
program.
Everybody's
favorite.
Yes, everyone's favorite. Is the landlord responsible for getting rid of them or other pests for that matter? And is this always the case?
The landlord is responsible for removing pests, things like bed bugs, roaches, ants, those kinds of things.
But what about slovenly habits of tenants?
Well, that's that that th- those become
they're leaving dirty dishes out and.
Great question. And I've always felt and I have to believe there's protection when a tenant causes a problem or repeatedly causes a problem. At some point, that tenant becomes responsible. It doesn't change the landlord's.
And of course, they're affecting the other tenants as
right,
well.
Right. And it doesn't change the landlord's responsibility to take care of those things. And certainly, as a landlord owner, I think you want to take care of those things. You don't necessarily want to leave that to your tenants. You want it to be handled professionally and correctly. And the law does require the landlord to take those steps. But I do think the landlord also has the right, if somebody is a particularly bad housekeeper, so to speak, to treat that as a lease violation, to issue a notice to cure, things like that. And if it's something that becomes habitual or repeated, it certainly, to me, it would be grounds for eviction, as well as perhaps a suit for damages.
But technically, the question Bonnie asked, though, is that the landlord is responsible. If you have some welts and you go to the doctor and they say you've been bitten by bed bugs, the landlord is responsible for taking care of that problem.
Well, that may start to get a little bit beyond the statute. The statute really contemplates responsibility for clearing up the problem. If somebody has an injury or is claiming an injury or an illness as a result of that, those become, I think, a little bit more tricky. And especially if you have a situation where someone maybe introduced the bed bug problem to the premises themselves. Again, those become fact-specific and questions that ultimately, if it's a personal injury suit, something like that, it's going to be up to a court. But that would be outside the landlord-tenant context.
I'm just thinking, you know, Lyme disease, it's not so common in South Florida. It's more common in the Northeast or the West or whatever. But if somebody did get bitten by a tick and they got Lyme disease, which has long-term repercussions, is the landlord or the owner responsible?
Well, I'd like to believe the answer is no. And the only way you're going to get to a situation where that's an issue is where I think you'd have a situation where the landlord knew of a problem, didn't take any action, and willfully ignored the responsibilities to protect the tenant from ticks. In many of those situations, I think that they'll be fact-specific. It may be something where the landlord really had no notice or the landlord acted as soon as he found out about the problem.
Jeffrey?
Yeah, I mean, I think where this problem comes up is when the landlord says to the tenant, you're the cause of it, and the tenant says, I didn't do anything wrong. It's the bed bugs were here, you know. And that's where it sometimes comes a fight. I know that some landlords have tried to charge tenants for the extermination costs, which can be expensive, when they believe the tenant is the one who caused it. And like Michael said, you know, it's very fact intensive. And the mm-hmm. statute really only talks about the extermination.
And it's the extermination of rats, mice, roaches, ants, wood destroying organisms, and bed bugs, as you had mentioned. And it's also important to note that when vacation of the premises is required for the extermination, the landlord shall not be liable for damages, but shall abate the rent. And the tenant shall be required to temporarily vacate the premises for a period of time not to exceed 4 days on 7 days written notice, if necessary, for the extermination pursuant to that law.
And during the time that they have to vacate, they don't have to pay the rent for those days?
I think the landlord would be putting the tenant up in an apartment or
no,
a hotel.
Not necessarily, no. In
or
fact,
someplace else.
No, it's an abatement of the rent, which means that the tenant is going to get a credit for those dates, and I literally do a proration of the rent for the number of days, but the landlord is not required to pay for a hotel, which often, in many cases, is going to far exceed the amount of the abatement.
Right.
But that's what the statute only requires, an abatement of the rent. If a unit has to be tented and the tenant has to vacate for 3 days or right. 4 days, they're only going to get a proration.
It says not liable for damages, but shall abate the rent.
Okay.
And we move along to calls. Another Boca caller. This is John. Hi there.
Hi. I'm calling because I'm appearing in court tomorrow. I had to sue my landlord to try and get my security deposit back. And his reasons for withholding the deposit were that damages were caused to the property. However, all of the damages caused were due to negligence of an upstairs neighbor. It was water leaking in. And I'm calling to find out if he actually has any legal ground to stand on.
Let's give a little disclaimer here. We're not giving specific legal advice, by the way. It's just a general conversation.
Right.
Who'd like to take that?
Well, I think provided that your landlord followed the proper procedure as far as giving a notice of claim, sending it to you within 30 days by certified mail to the address that you provided, if the landlord has a legitimate claim that the tenant failed to take proper care, that there was damage or something beyond normal wear and tear like we talked about, the tenant does have the right to object. The tenant typically has 15 days from the date he receives the notice of claim to send a written response saying, I object to those items. And it sounds like that's probably what happened here. There's actually been a change in the law that says that even if you don't do that, it doesn't mean you give up your right to do it later on in court.
Can't there be some form of arbitration so these things don't have to go to court that would be binding?
Well, there really isn't. There really isn't. Once the process has played out where the landlord has given the notice of claim, the tenant has had a chance to respond, the landlord can either accept what the tenant's objections are and say, gee, okay, I agree. The landlord can say, I don't agree, and this is what I'm going to do.
Or you can say, maybe we'll split the difference.
The parties are encouraged to work things out on their own before. This gentleman is already in court. He's likely to go to a pretrial where the judge will likely order the parties to attend mediation first, which is a chance to work things out in the courthouse but not in front of a judge with an impartial mediator whose job is to try to get the parties to come together. So that it doesn't need to go to a trial. But it's going to be a fact-specific. Every case is going to be fact-specific, such as the one from the caller. If the caller has evidence, exhibits, documentation to show that he was not the cause of it, of any damage, and that the landlord, in the landlord's failure to act, was really the one that caused it, that may affect the outcome of the case.
So the burden of proof is on the tenant.
Correct. Correct. Well, correct.
Jeffrey?
Yeah. Yeah. If the landlord has followed the correct procedures, I guess the landlord, the tenant really does have the burden to show I didn't cause that. I mean, I sort of argue the landlord still has a burden to show that they didn't contribute to it, I think, because it would turn into sort of a defense that they'd have to prove.
The bottom line is the tenant has to give the landlord the premises back in the same condition as he or she acquired it. And if the tenant noticed irregularities, they should have sent a notice to cure, given the landlord 7 days to cure this defect. Otherwise, there would be consequences.
That's really an excellent point from a landlord's perspective, because I get that question all the time. Where a tenant will be moving out and saying, gee, I've had this problem for months and you never took care of it. And the managers say to me, gee, they never told me about it. And there really is a shared responsibility as far as taking care of a unit. Obviously, those things that are the landlord's responsibility remain the landlord's responsibility. But the tenant does have an obligation, I think, to speak up and to say, listen, you may not know about this, but there's water leaking into my unit.
And I think this important lesson is always document things. I have so many tenants we speak to who say, well, I told my landlord this. And, you know, you don't want to be in court eventually and it be someone's word against someone else's word. If you have an email, a letter, you're going to be in a lot better position.
Do you need to have those letters or email, or should it be a letter that's certified, for example?
I mean, you can. It depends on what you're trying to do. In the statute, you can. A tenant has the ability to tell the landlord, if you don't make repairs, I'm going to withhold rent if you don't make these repairs within 7 days. Now, that needs to be very formal. I'd suggest sending by certified mail. It doesn't have to be delivered that way. But if you're going to withhold rent and use that mechanism, you got to follow the statute.
There's so many foreclosures now. If a landlord loses a property as a result of foreclosure, are tenants protected from immediate eviction by the new owner?
Back in 2009, Congress passed the Protecting Tenants at Foreclosure Act, and it will be in existence until the end of 2014 as of now. What that law says is that the new owner of the property must either honor the lease of the tenant. So if the tenant has a lease that goes until December of this year, the new owner, must honor that lease. Or if there is no lease, they must give at least 90 days notice.
Okay.
at that point, once that notice expired, they can go to the foreclosure court and they can ask for the tenant to be removed. Now, the tenant is responsible for still paying their rent to the new owner. If they don't pay the rent, just like any other landlord, the new owner steps into the shoes of the old landlord. So they can do the, they can charge the rent. They can evict a tenant if the tenant doesn't follow the lease. So all those obligations are still there.
Can they raise the rent?
Not if you have a lease. Now, if you're a month-to-month tenant, they could raise the rent. That means somebody who doesn't have a lease and just pays their rent on each month. Now, you could argue if a landlord raised the rent dramatically and was trying to force the tenant out, that they were really trying to get around this law. And if they did that in bad faith, I think a tenant would have a good defense to that.
And just on the same issue, if a property is undergoing foreclosure, the owner is no longer making mortgage payments, is a tenant still required to pay the rent?
Yes.
Okay.
And especially with this new law, because your tenancy survives. It's sort of like the tenancy has nothing to do with the foreclosure process.
We're speaking about landlord-tenant relations today, and our guests are Leonard Elias. He's the Miami-Dade County Consumer Advocate, Jeffrey Hearn of Legal Services of Greater Miami, and Michael Bernholtz, who is an attorney representing mostly owners.
In private practice.
In private practice. And we're going to take a short break, and we'll be back and take more of your calls.
And it is today's topical occurrence, Joseph Cooper, Bonnie Berman, along with attorneys Jeffrey Hearn, Leonard Elias, and Michael Bernholtz. We're talking about landlord-tenant law. If you'd like to join in, 1-800-743-9576, 1-800-743-WLRN. And we'll move to George in Hollywood. Hi there.
Hello.
Hello.
Go ahead, George.
Okay, I couldn't hear you for a second. Yes, I have a question for your guest regarding this Tenant Protection Act of 2009. What happens if the tenants are, by surprise, the sheriff shows up one day and they get evicted on that very day, and the owner, the new owner, knew about it, knew that they were there. Okay, so this violates that act, apparently. They didn't have any notice. But my question is, is it worth it for them to go after this guy? Is what are the penalties and what are the damages? What can they, you know, get from being evicted in such a harsh way, which kind of turned their lives upside down?
Well, this is one of the frustrating things about the law, and actually a decision just came down a couple of weeks ago from the Ninth Circuit Federal Court. There is no, and all the courts have held that there is no private right of action, meaning you can't go to court and sue a landlord or sue an owner who violates this law. The courts have held that it is only to be used defensively in the state court action, so in this case, the foreclosure. So what a tenant in this situation should do is, go back to that court that ordered the eviction and ask to be put back in possession. It may not work, but that's what the remedy is. We have a few creative ideas in our office, but
I guess stand your ground doesn't qualify either.
Well, a lot of people think if Congress passes a law, well, then you can go to court to enforce it. But unfortunately, that's not true.
A useless law.
It's not useless. It's provided a lot of protection for a lot of people. But in those situations where someone is wrongfully evicted, it doesn't provide a remedy.
You have to know beforehand that it's going to happen. If you get caught by surprise and the tenants are saying, what do you? What's the sheriff doing here, drilling the locks? That's okay.
Yeah.
Thank you.
Okay, thanks for calling, George. Here's a question from Jose. The landlord is required to provide air conditioning. The AC in the property is working, meaning it runs, it's cooling. But the tenant claims it's not sufficient in some instances during daytime and super hot days. Is the landlord liable somehow? How can it be measured or assessed if the AC is adequate?
Well, I presume that the AC is something that's required by the lease because it's actually not required under the statute, even in Florida.
It's not?
That is correct.
So if you sign a lease, you better be sure that you have air conditioning.
Yes and no. But at the same time, I mean, I've always said that if something's there present when you move in, there's an expectation that it's going to continue to be there and it's going to work. And the landlord doesn't get an out to say, aha, the AC broke, I don't have to fix it. So there is there there's there are other things that require the landlord to maintain the air conditioning, and obviously it should be maintained so that it's doing its job and
even on
its
hot days.
Even on hot days,
of
and
course.
Again, a lot of these things are going to become fact specific. We alluded to the tenant's remedy in all these situations. If you believe your landlord is not meeting its obligations, is not doing what he's supposed to be doing by either not fixing things, not maintaining them properly, you have the right as a tenant to provide written notice to your landlord at least 7 days before your rent is due, giving your landlord notice of whatever it is that's not being done. And you have the right at that point to withhold rent. You don't have a right to go out and make the repair on your own and say, I'm just going to take it off the next month's rent.
What if you got a free written estimate from an air conditioning company and then presented that to the landlord?
Well,
that it's not performing up to a satisfactory level.
Well, I've always said to my clients, the things that are your responsibility remain your responsibility. So whether a tenant, I usually get this question related sometimes to mold, where a tenant will go out and have his own company do a mold spore test, or will buy a kit at Home Depot and do that and say, aha, I have a problem. Those things that are the landlord's responsibility remain the landlord's responsibility. And I think the landlord has the right to fix things in a way that he wants to do it, with using his own people, is provided that it's done professionally and correctly. And the tenant doesn't get to dictate to the owner how something is done. It's still the owner's right and responsibility.
But in that case of the mold, if he does show with this home test from Home Depot or this that there is mold, is the landlord required to address that?
Well, I think they need to at least address the issue. Whether it means the landlord does its own testing at that point, I think would probably be appropriate. The landlord doesn't necessarily need to accept everything that a tenant cooks up. And I'm sorry to sound like such a landlord's advocate, but I feel strongly about this, that a tenant has the right to bring up an issue, obviously, but the landlord still has the right to address it within the legal framework, within the legal time period, and then to make repairs as the landlord sees fit, again, provided that it's done legally, correctly, professionally, etc.
Mm-hmm. Let's go back to our phones. James in Miami. Hey, James, thanks for your patience. Hi.
Hey, how are you? My question is whether I have anything but a civil remedy against a property manager. A property manager I had on a property failed to pass along the rental payments to me for 2 months, and is also retaining the security deposit. Has failed to give me the security deposit. The tenants have agreed that they screwed up the house and that the damages exceed the security deposit. So I'm trying to get the security deposit out of the property manager. They won't give it to me or the rent that I'm out. Do I have anything but a civil remedy against him?
Well, if you think someone has stolen from you, essentially, at this point, I think you do have the right to contact the police. Whether or not they're charges that they're going to pursue, I'm not sure I can answer that. But, I think primarily the case you're talking about or the situation, it sounds like one where it would more likely be addressed through the civil courts, again, provided that you know where this manager is. There are ways of trying to get back that money. It's really outside the landlord-tenant context. And the tenants, from the tenant's perspective, they're saying it's really not our problem that the manager didn't give you the money. We gave the deposit to the person who was authorized, at least at that time, to take it. But I think you do have the right to contact the police.
Leonard, could some of these things be resolved in small claims court?
Department of Regulatory and Economic Resources, Consumer Protection Section, does handle security deposit issues when they are...
How about a contact number for
and,
your office?
Our contact number is 305-375-3677. And consumers can call, and an investigative analyst will handle the dispute or controversy. And all of our investigative analysts are certified mediators by the Florida Supreme Court. And we make every effort to facilitate a resolution. Consumers can also go online Our tenants could also go online to register complaints by going to miamidade.gov/business and typing on consumer protection, and there's a section to file a complaint. If push comes to shove, most likely the complaint will be personal and private between the landlord and the tenant, and only a judge really can adjudicate the matter and require the landlord to pay the security deposit.
Also in Broward, if you're listening in Broward, the Broward Consumer Affairs Office is at 954-765-4400, extension 9674. I'm sure Broward Consumer Affairs also has a website that you can get more information.
And while we're at it, Jeffrey, what's your contact information for Legal Services of Greater Miami?
Phone number is 305-576-0080.
And Michael Bernholz, how about contact info for you?
Sure. Our office can be reached at 305-868-5368.
Okay.
Okay. I have a question on one of these laws, that this new law eliminates a landlord's obligation to make certain disclosures regarding fire safety to tenants. What's that about? Do either of you know?
I think the law requires that be provided as a matter of law, and so therefore it's not necessary to incorporate that in the disclosures in the lease. I think that was the primary purpose of just eliminating it. The law requires it anyway, so therefore why put that language into the lease when it's just required by law?
But it says eliminates a landlord's obligation to make disclosures regarding fire safety.
Right. There were certain disclosures that the old law had. I've got to take a moment to find out where they were, but
we're playing stump the band here.
I'm not trying to.
Well, I think they had to disclose previously whether the building, which was more than three stories high, had fire protection or not, and I think the idea is that most of these buildings are now required to have it, so you don't need to tell the tenant whether you have or don't have it.
Okay, so...
There were a lot of changes that weren't very important.
And that probably was one of them.
Yeah.
All right, just a quick emailer to Shia. If you purchase a property that's been foreclosed on and the owner still lives in the property, what's the relationship and what rights do each party have?
Well, I think we were talking about that in terms of if you purchase a unit. I'm not sure if the emailer is asking if she's purchased it at a foreclosure sale. If that's the case... there is an exception to the Protecting a Tenants at Foreclosure Act that allows a buyer who intends to live in the unit as his primary residence to actually go to the court and can evict and remove the tenant. It's really the only situation.
Well, I think it was an owner.
Where the owner is still living there.
Yes.
Right. Well, then if you're the buyer of the unit, you have a right to occupy that and have a right to remove whoever's there.
Topical Currents, speaking to Jeffrey Hearn, Michael Bernholz, and Leonard Elias, and we'll be right back.
And 47 minutes past 1 o'clock, it is today's Topical Currents. Joseph Cooper, Bonnie Berman, along with Jeffrey Hearn, Leonard Elias, and Michael Bernholz. You have a email there?
Yes, this
is
from Marcelo. After giving my tenant the 3-day notice, I went to court to start the eviction process and filed a complaint and summons. My tenant now contacted me and is willing to pay to stay. If he pays and I decide to let him stay, what should I do with the process I started at court?
Well, I would say if the tenant's paid in full and the landlord's satisfied, the landlord should properly dismiss this case by filing a notice of dismissal with the court.
So that's what they have to do is file a notice of dismissal.
It's a notice of voluntary dismissal.
Okay.
Right, provided that that's the end of it. I typically had a question where a landlord client will call me and say, gee, the tenant wants to pay, but I'm concerned about next month or the following month. Mm-hmm. The parties at that point have a right to make an agreement, typically called the stipulation, where the parties could make certain agreements as far as rent going forward. The benefit to the landlord in those situations is that if the tenant fails to comply, the landlord may be able to move forward with the eviction without having to start the whole process again, paying a new eviction filing fee, serving the lawsuit, etc.
Okay.
But they'd have to reopen the case of them and pay a small filing fee.
But it would be less expensive and less time-consuming than starting the process all over again.
Next caller, Alberto in Doral. Hi.
Hi, good afternoon. I just wanted to clarify something. I understand the answer regarding that if a new owner buys a foreclosed property, if the current tenant has a lease until April of 2014, the new owner needs to and must honor that lease. But I think that it was mentioned just a little while ago. I just want to clarify it. If the new owner intends to live in the property, it's just a legal procedure to go to the court and testify that, yes, I will take possession of the property as my primary home residence. And in that case, how many months does the tenant have in order to vacate the premises?
Right, there is an exception to what was discussed before, and that exception is if the new owner wants to occupy the home as his or her personal residence, in which case they must give you at least 90 days notice before terminating the tenancy.
So you get the tenant still gets the 90 days if the new owner wants to move in.
And we go to Lynn in North Miami Beach. Hello.
Oh, yes, hi. Hello.
Hi.
I just was going to ask a question. Are these laws pertaining to condominiums also?
Residential. We're talking about residential leases versus commercial leases. And
right,
you can
okay.
live in a condominium and have a residential lease.
Right. This is for all rental properties, whether it's a house, a condominium, even a mobile home in some instances. But it doesn't. This is separate from condominium law and things like that.
What if someone sublets a condo to a renter, and they're not keeping up with their homeowners association payments?
You're talking about if the owner is not keeping
right.
up and the tenant's saying...
But the tenant is still paying rent
right. well,
as agreed upon.
Well, I would say that the tenant's obligation doesn't go away, although at some point, if the landlord's not paying the association, there are a number of problems, one of which under the condo statute is the association has the right to step in and demand that the tenant pay rent to the condominium. Mm-hmm. While the delinquency remains. And if the tenant fails to comply with that, the condominium can actually file an eviction lawsuit as if it were the landlord or owner of the property.
Nicholas has a question. Is there a cap in which a landlord can raise rent for a lease renewal? If the lease is renewed each year with the landlord and tenant per original lease, does the building association need a new lease each year? So there are two questions.
Well, the first question, there is no statutory cap in Florida about how much you can raise the rent. The parties are each lease period can make whatever arrangements they wish. They're not required to enter into a new lease. You can't force the other side to take a specific deal. And the second question, I believe, was
about... If the lease is renewed each year, does the building association need a new lease?
That's going to be specific to each building.
Okay.
I mean, some condominiums or associations will require a new lease every year. Some will take an addendum to the existing lease, and some are probably less interested.
And next caller, Mark in Fort Lauderdale. Mark, we're short on time. Please be brief.
Yes. Very quick question about condo associations and condo associations and people living under certain rules. So I'm in a condo association, for example. They have no one under 55. We just recently had a child, so... Condo association. What are the? We're paying the maintenance and everything like that. What are the? What basically are their options? In other words, if this went fully lengthed out in court, how long would it take? And what are their options? Even though I'm paying the maintenance and I'm a homeowner in the association.
Well, Florida does have a designation for certain communities to be 55 and over. I'm not sure, without going into the specifics of your case, I'm not sure I can either give advice or give an estimate about what would happen if your situation has changed and therefore you're no longer in qualification for the 55-plus.
But they wouldn't be able to use the eviction process if you're an owner. They'd have to go through another court process or a foreclosure process.
Correct.
So what's your advice for Mark? Get his own personal attorney.
Yeah, he's going to have to. Somebody's going to have to look at the rules for his association and figure out what he should do.
I think I could hear said child in the background earlier.
Mm.
I already looked at the association rules. For the most part, they're about non-payment, not really so much about removing people. The letter that we received from the association was to remove the child, not remove the family.
Oh.
Well,
good luck.
If if a tenant lives in a property that's put up for sale, what are the requirements of the owner in terms of showing the apartment? I mean, what is required of the tenant to show the apartment, and what rights does the tenant have in terms of when it's shown?
Well, the landlord does have a right to access the property for certain things, including showing the apartment. But typically, it must be done in a manner that's reasonable and not overly intrusive on the tenant.
They can't just show up at 10 o'clock at night.
Right, right. I always advise my landlord clients, if you're going to be showing the unit, you should be providing written notice in advance.
How far in advance?
I believe it's 12 hours in advance for a period between, I think it's either 7:30 in the morning and 8:30 at night. It's in 83.53 is the actual statute. And the tenant cannot unreasonably withhold access, can't say to the landlord, you can't ever come in here. The tenant can say, gee, that's not a good time for me. Can you do it the next day, or can you do it only in the mornings, but can't give a wholesale, I'm not ever letting you in.
Of course, but they can have, like, they're sick or they're, you know, not able to do it on a certain day, they have company or...
Again, it's going to become fact specific, provided that the landlord doesn't, that the tenant doesn't abuse that right.
It's 83.53 subsection 2. Reasonable notice is 12 hours between 7:30 and 8 o'clock p.m.
Okay.
And the statute does not require written notice.
Well, we're just about out of time, so I want to give all this contact information. Leonard Elias is the Miami-Dade County Consumer Advocate. Website, miamidade.gov/business, and then you go to Consumer Affairs, Leonard. Is that it?
Yes, the Department of Regulatory and Economic Resources. It's Business Affairs, and we're the Consumer Protection Section.
And that number is 305-375-3677. Michael Bernholz is an attorney, and his number is 305-868-5368, usually representing the owners. And Jeffrey Hearn is a senior attorney at Legal Services of Greater Miami. His number is 305-576-0080. And we thank you all for being
here. It's been a very interesting hour, gentlemen. Thank you very much.
Thanks so much.
And that wraps up today's program. Our producer is Richard Ives. Technical direction from Caroline Brader Watts. Paul Leary is online producer. We have free audio archives and downloads at our website. That's WLRN.org. Also, more information and links at the Topical Currents Facebook page. You'll enjoy tomorrow's program. It's our famous restaurant roundabout with Linda Gassenheimer. Get the latest on the South Florida culinary scene and call in with your favorite restaurants. We'll be joined by Jen Karednick and our favorite wine columnist, Fred Tasker. And the calendar. On this day in 1777, 236 years ago, French nobleman, the Marquis de Lafayette, is named a major general in the Continental Army. He was but 19 years old and was wounded at the Battle of Brandywine. A general at 19. And on this day in 1919, 94 years ago, the birth of broadcast legend Kurt Gowdy, in one of my favorite towns, Green River, Wyoming. He was the longtime voice of the Boston Red Sox, worked for ABC and NBC, and called the first Super Bowl. He died in 26 in Palm Beach, Florida. And one more on this day in 1972, 41 years ago, Missouri Senator Thomas Eagleton, vice presidential nominee, withdraws from the Democratic presidential ticket of George McGovern 6 days after admitting he'd once been hospitalized for mental health problems. Our theme music created by Michael Levine. So we leave with a thought from author John Updike describing Kurt Gowdy's homespun broadcast demeanor. Quote, "He sounds just like everyone's brother-in-law." Joseph Cooper with Bonnie Berman. Next up is Here and Now from NPR News.